on a different aspect of the Donald Trump administration. Until then, I'm your host, Jesse Lent. Talk to you next time.
Everybody loves the sunshine. Sunshine.
Turning 15 on the Road to Freedom tells the moving, true story of Linda Blackman, the youngest person to walk all the way from Selma to Montgomery, Alabama, on the Voting Rights March in 1965. Jailed 9 times before her 15th birthday, Lowry fought alongside with Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. to secure the right to vote for African Americans. This amazing story has been adapted to a play, and performances will be held at Riverside Church on Saturday, January 19th at 2 p.m. and 7 p.m. and on Sunday, January 20th at 2 p.m. and 6 p.m. For more information, you can call 212-870-6792 or go online to turning15riverside.eventbrite.com.
You're listening to WBAI. This is Kiani Brea with an announcement about your local station board elections. Ballots will be issued by first-class postal mail on January 18th and will be issued by email on January 23rd. The local station board election will close on March 5th, 2019. For other important dates and for information about voting in the election, you may call 413-424-9569 or visit wbai.org.
This is the mic check for Cat Radio Cafe.
Testing.
Testing.
Stay tuned for the new 2-hour Cat Radio Cafe Sunday night at 11 on WBAI.
I'm Janet Coleman.
I'm David Dozer,
the displaced playwright. On Sunday, January 20th, we will talk with editor, essayist, satirist, and wit, Louis H. Lapham, on the timely reissue of his book, Money and Class in America. Actress and activist Kathleen Chalfant appearing in The Courtroom, a play about an immigration trial performed in an actual courtroom, some radio shorties, and a conversation about rich friends.
Sunday night at 11 on WBAI, the new 2-hour Cat Radio Cafe. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook.
Cat Radio Cafe.
Hey, do cats drink coffee?
If it's brewed with fish.
The revolutionary time, all over the globe. Men are revolting against old systems of exploitation and oppression. And out of the wounds of a frail world, new systems of justice and equality are being born.
We're Building Bridges Monday, January 21st from 7 to 10 p.m. to the radical Martin Luther King. The country is in the midst of an agenda of fear, racism, and white nationalism. It's declared war on its workers, and ever more people are being consumed by poverty. To inspire and guide us to fight poverty, not the poor, we'll reconsecrate and raise up the radical king who challenged the triple pillars upon which capitalism rests, racism, militarism, and poverty. Building Bridges, Monday, January 21st, from 7 to 10 p.m.
And you're listening to radio station WBAI in New York. The time is just about 7 o'clock. And that means it's time for another edition of Off the Hook here on WBAI.
The telephone keeps ringing, so I ripped it off the wall. I cut myself while shaving, now I can't make a call. We couldn't get much worse. We'll be right back.
And a very good evening to everybody. The program is Off the Hook. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you, joined tonight by Alex.
Good evening.
Kyle.
Hey.
Walter. Walter's in the background.
Hello.
And Mitch Altman is joining us.
Hello.
Wow. So here we are. Kyle, we're back from weeks of travel.
Yes.
All right. We're kind of shell-shocked, so bear with us, please. We're just getting used to things. It's about 90 degrees in the studio for some reason. Our new studio is being built as we speak, so you might hear some hammering and cursing, which we'll do our best to mute. We have all kinds of stories to talk about in the world of hacking, in the world of technology. Oh, and yes, we're on at 7 o'clock now. Did you notice that? We're on an hour earlier. I know you guys did this last week, an hour earlier. And how did that go?
I just feel so much less efficient. Uh-huh. I lost a day, daylight savings.
I learned about it on page 6 of the Post, you know, the gossip thing. That's where they alert people that things have changed. And, now we're back in our usual time slot. I like it better. I like it better at 7 o'clock. Because
it's a little jarring.
You get to meet a lot more people on the highway coming in. In fact, did they find the child? Kyle, we were driving in, and there was this amber alert, and all the signs everywhere, amber alert, tuned to local media.
Yeah, there was no information whatsoever. I think when I looked at my phone, it was Bronx related.
Whatever, but the point is, why in God's name don't they have the information on the big sign that they used to have a license plate number or something? Instead, they say Amber Alert, tune to local media. Well, you know, this is local media right here. We're in local media, and we have no idea what child is missing from where. So, you know, we can't help you. So if you've gone to us after looking at the sign, sorry. And the same thing is true of other radio stations as well. They don't know, or they're not. You know, I'm not going to listen to an hour of country music just to hear one announcement about some missing kid. Okay, so folks, whose idea, Alex, you're a lawyer, you should know these things. Whose idea was it to stop using the sign to convey the information that's important that people on the road should know about, such as this car has a kidnapped kid in it with this license plate? Instead, now you have to go to a radio station somewhere and hope that maybe they're talking about that and then somehow keep track of the information they're talking about.
I don't know what being a lawyer has to do with identifying...
Because you know things.
That kind of idiocy.
And you're responsible for things.
Yeah, but I have no idea, frankly, who did this, but it is such a bad idea.
It's the worst idea ever.
It's absolutely terrible.
I got so frustrated driving around before. It was awful. Actually, Kyle, you were driving, but I got frustrated anyway.
But to answer the question, I do believe that the child was found.
Oh, good.
I received a separate alert on my phone that actually said the child was
And that's
found.
Another thing. You know, we're trying to listen to the FA Cup with Southampton, and I don't know if they beat Derby or not. We were, you know, really riveted to that game, listening on TuneIn, and all of a sudden we get this emergency alert tone with the same message on our phones saying tune to local media. And again, you know, local media isn't going to have this information. Why don't you just give us the information instead of sending us all these alerts telling us to do something else to get the information?
Yeah, it was a lot of overlap of technologies interrupting one another, and then to just only get this sort of vague non-message.
It's just, you know, I have a particular issue with technology that is designed poorly. You know, when you have something that's a great idea, but then you just do something stupid, such as a design of subway cars, where you know they have arrows pointing the wrong way when you know of the direction the car is moving, and you're supposed to keep track of the subway station that comes up next. Little things like that, or you know announcements that don't convey the information, or that tell the time wrong, or just are inane and stupid. There's all kinds of ways you can make things better. We see this when we travel around the world. We see things that work. We were in the London Underground, and you see, you know, basic information such as what the next stop is. And it's displayed in lettering that's clear, that doesn't flicker, that's, you know, consistent. And then we come back here and we see all kinds of things that just don't make any sense. It could be done so much better. And, you know, I like to think there are people out there that are thinking of better ways to do things. But sometimes you have to kind of ask people, you know, what do you want? And I get the feeling that's not happening enough.
Yeah, I feel like we're sorely in need of some technological ergonomics that haven't quite bubbled to the surface in these new schemes, especially here at home. We see great examples of good implementations of it, especially in like transit and stuff when we're in other cities. But I guess it's that we want it for our home and to see it in places that matter to us every day and the people we care about. back home. We know we can do it, but it just seems like it gets to be like a back burner thing. It doesn't ever really become the priority.
We've been in a number of cities since we were here in the studio last, and London and Krakow, Warsaw, and every city seems to have it down as far as, say you're on a bus. You always know what stop is coming up because it's displayed. You don't need to know the language. And, you know, in a city like New York, we should have things like that. We should be able to have a display that tells you what's coming up next or how long it's going to be before a bus or a train is going to show up. And it's actually based in reality. We don't seem to have that. I don't know why it's so difficult for us.
Yeah, building up two points on the design issue. You know, number one, these Amber Alerts, when they come up, if they're not giving the information, they're telling you to tune in somewhere else. It's actually really dangerous, especially if you're driving and you want to get the information, and all of a sudden you're opening up a web browser on your phone. Really idiotic. And I don't know why. I would love to know why it changed from actually displaying the information that was relevant at that particular moment to not displaying that information and telling you to tune in somewhere else. But then building off your separate point, which is the London Underground point, one thing that I miss, having lived in London and now living in New York again, were two different lanes to enter and exit the subway. You know, I actually travel on the subway a lot now with my dogs back and forth to work, two dogs, and take them on the subway. Probably not really supposed to do it.
But two different lanes to enter the subway. I'm trying to picture what
so
that is.
There's an entrance and an exit. You know, there aren't people going in and out of the same turnstile at the same moment, which we have in New
York. Yes, they have a green light and a red light.
Exactly. So you don't have this traffic jam problem that I have to suffer through every single day. And when you're trying to get two dogs through a turnstile at rush hour in the morning.
Why are you taking two dogs on the subway?
Well, sometimes if it's raining or if it's extraordinarily cold out and I don't feel like walking, I just take my dogs on the subway.
Yeah, first of all, you're not supposed to do that, but I think you should, because every city we were in, people take their dogs on the train, and the dogs behave themselves. But for some reason, the trains are a whole lot quieter. I don't get that either. Why are their trains so much quieter than our trains?
Well, especially
they're still
in
trains.
London.
They're still tracks. Why? What's the difference?
Yeah. Oh, you mean the actual noise from the trains? I thought you meant the chatter
in the
cars. Yeah,
because dogs don't like that. Dogs don't like loud trains like we have in this city.
That's true. Jimmy does bark at the trains when they arrive, but once he's on board, he's pretty calm.
He barks at buses and skateboarders, too.
He does. That's true. That's right. Yeah.
I think they're legal in New York if they fit in a bag.
Well, that's true. However, I do have to say, I have never, I should knock on wood, I have never had a problem bringing the dogs into the subway. In fact, I'll often stand right where the conductors, line up with the car there, and I just wave at them. They wave at me. We get on the train, and there you go. I've never really had a problem. And I agree with this. I think this is a great form of civil disobedience in New York, taking your dog on the train. I want to see more people do it.
I'm not quite sure that's what I had in mind. I would just like to see things improve a little bit where technology makes more sense. And where things are just easier to use. But I know Kyle, when we were traveling, we had some issues as well. It wasn't all perfect.
Sorry, I'm just laughing. Yeah, I know in Germany you can buy a ticket for your dog.
That's true. Many cities.
When you go on the train, and I think in England too, there are dog tickets. So just pointing that out. But yeah, it should be so comprehensive that it's not a problem. And yeah.
Okay. Well, anyway, things were not perfect for us everywhere we went. Sometimes things didn't work.
No. When I was translating all of the messages on that machine, one of the things I was noticing was dog ticket and chat. No, that's not what we need.
But we were able to do that. We were on a train that only spoke Polish and German.
It was
and
really
we were able
cool.
to buy a ticket on that train somehow.
We were going through the screen menu to buy the ticket with like a translating app. So we could just basically watch all the options get translated in real time. That was pretty cool, clever use of that. So that when we were checked, we had the right zones and could get to where we needed to go precisely and not at a really high cost. But everything had a certain level of resistance, a little bit of trouble, a little difficulty. That's part of, I think, the general thing that we like to talk about with adjusting and learning new systems when you're abroad. If you make a game of it, I think you tend to build your skills and learning new systems and being able to compare that stuff.
Comparing, I think that's the key. When you go places and you see how other people do it, instead of resisting, take notes and come back with those notes, and you'll find that you can apply things. Here's a great example. I don't know if people have noticed this. Inside the New York City subway, there's a unique system at play that only exists in one other part of the world. And we heard about this, didn't believe it, saw some videos of it on YouTube. But in Japan, there are train conductors and train engineers. And you'll notice for some reason they're pointing at everything when they're moving the trains. They point their, it's like they're giving a tour to somebody. They keep pointing at things, and you wonder what in God's name are they up to. Well, it turns out that is a particular way of being able to pay attention to a task by pointing at an object as it appears, by expecting an object to be there and by recognizing it. It's a particular type of training that they have in Japan. And at one point, one of the heads of the transit authority here in New York went to Japan, saw this, was so impressed by it that he mandated that New York City transit employees, at least on the subway, do this whenever they pull into a station. So if you watch a train go into a station and you see the conductor who is in the middle, you will see every time he or she will point their finger when the train arrives in the station. And they'll be pointing it at this little checked box that's in every station in the middle of the platform. When the train pulls in, they point. It's a way of being alert, kind of checking in. And it's an example of how you can take something from another place, another culture, apply it, and see things improve.
When you told me about this, when you first learned about it, I thought you were just, you know, completely lying to me, and that, you know, it's one of your, you know, your practical jokes, mm-hmm. something else is going to happen entirely. But it is amazing to see this, and it's like clockwork. I mean, some stations, however, if they have trains that have 8 cars and 10 cars, mm-hmm. there's two of those checkered boxes near the middle of the station.
No, there should be only one, because if train is, you'll see a little rectangular sign that says 8 and 10 telling the driver where to stop, depending on how many cars he has. But the middle of the train should always be in the same place, so there should only be one of those.
I've seen stations where there's actually two.
Okay.
Yeah, right. I think at Times Square, it might be the ACE, might have two boxes in there. But
we'll check it after the show, Alex.
Let's do it. Let's validate this. Yes. So we'll settle this once and for all.
Call me a liar on the air. Okay, go ahead.
I've called you worse.
Uh-huh, I know that.
But it really is amazing, though. And, you know, practically, I mean, let's say, you know, this is something really good to know, this little bit of trivia, because let's say you're feeling somewhat unsafe and you're waiting for the train at 2 o'clock in the morning. Mm-hmm. You might want to be right underneath that particular box that has the checkered pattern on it, because you know that's right where the conductor is going to be when he pulls up.
Then you wait in the off-hour waiting area with the orange that they have on every stop as well, which should encompass that particular little plaid thing.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
Anyway, that's one example. There are so many other things that you notice when you travel, and you should bring it back. There's always ways of improving not only technology, but our everyday life, you know, how people treat each other, how people get through the day. I think this is one of many examples when you go away for a few weeks. Now, Mitch, you're constantly on the road. In fact, it's rare that we see you here. Not that this is your home, but it's close. Where is your home anyway? Do you even know?
Where the heart is? I travel a lot. I do have an apartment in San Francisco, so I guess I can say I live there. I also have an apartment in Berlin now.
Okay,
so
good.
I guess I can say I live there too.
So just accumulate apartments as you travel.
If I could afford it, maybe I'd have more. But my apartments are actually quite inexpensive, so I can afford the two. And I'm traveling most of the time, though. I've been in San Francisco in 2018, only 6 weeks. And in Berlin, about 2 months.
Okay. And we saw you at the Chaos Communication Congress in Berlin, and in Leipzig.
In Leipzig.
And so how did this year's compare as far as you're concerned?
Well, my perspective is rather limited. I organize the rather large now hardware hacking area, and that was pretty much home for 5 days, setting up and then cleaning up surrounding the conference. And that was amazing. We had well over 2,000 people who soldered there during the conference, and most of those people had never done it before, including a whole group of 4 to 6 year olds.
I saw that. I walked by and I saw Mitch teaching a bunch of really tiny kids how to solder.
Yeah, it's really adorable when these little kids are holding soldering irons and making these kids were all making these little blinky light things that I designed so people could learn to solder. And and everyone gets to play with it afterwards. From my perspective, this was the best one ever, and they seem to get better every year, even though, you know, some people miss the earlier days when there were only, that's a weird word, only 2,000 people at these Congress events. And
I actually am one of those people that miss that, because kind of like Hope, you know, we're at a certain size. When you get much bigger than that, and they were at like 18,000 now, it's still amazing. It's still an awesome event, but it's not the same event. You know, it's lost something along the way.
Yeah, it loses some things and it gains some things. Mm-hmm. I mean, I remember the discussions around that when it was getting too crowded for the venue that it started at. When I first went with 2,000 people in Berlin, and then it outgrew that place, and we're wondering, well, should we grow? Should we stay the same? What do we lose? What do we gain? But there are so many people who can benefit from going to these events, and we didn't want to actually just limit it to just the people who'd already gone and make it somewhat elitist.
I think the growth is actually, they're growing into the spaces that were quite a bit larger than the second spot in Hamburg. Once you get, you increase your size, of course, there's growing room and getting into that. And particularly the art and design, I think, was really beautiful. There was all kinds of different themes in different areas, and they're definitely filling out the space that they're currently running the event in. Like, there was a particular place that had a No Borders bar, which was beautiful. It looked like a checkpoint, and they had a little hut and several little gates and stuff like that, just to make it feel like it's from some kind of abandoned border entry point. Little artistic things like that, I think, took a while as these kinds of events grow to actually take advantage of. You know, once you get a new and larger space, you're always thinking about how can people enjoy it more? How can you get more hacking going on in any one square meter? But it's really brilliant to see that evolve slowly and see the kind of expression that goes on with that art and other production.
Now, the Chaos Camp takes place every year, same dates, December 27th, 28th, 29th, and 30th. Currently it's in Leipzig. It was in Hamburg before that. I don't know if they can go back to Hamburg because they've grown bigger than the massive space they had there. That space is being reconstructed, but I don't know when they're finished, if it's going to be big enough. I do know also they're having a camp this summer. Right. Is that right, Mitch?
Yeah. It'll be, August 19th to 25th during that week, and probably Thursday to Sunday in there. And it happens every 4 years, and those are amazing. As great as the annual Congress is, the camps are just over the top, wonderful.
It used to be the camps were bigger, but I think now the Congress is bigger, you can't fit that many people outside anymore.
Right. Yeah, the camp, the discussion after the last one, it had 5,000 last time. The discussion was maybe to make it 7,000 because that might fit, but I'm not sure what was decided. Uh-huh. That's a lot of people. But it's everyone's there, you know, unlike when it's a big event in a city where people can come and go. There's no, you know, barbed wire to keep anyone in or anything, but once you're there, there's not really anywhere to go, really. So everyone's just there. They're there for the duration, and everyone adds their life to it in this place, way away from the day to day, which makes it quite magical.
Mm-hmm. We had a lot of fun though when we were in Leipzig. We were just wandering around. One thing though, we took the tram into town. They keep the trams running around the clock, but we discovered a slight flaw in the system because we took the tram into town to get food away from the venue, which, you know, we do no matter where we go. And then we discovered while the trams were running and taking people into town all night long, getting back seemed impossible. In fact, it was impossible because nobody knew how to do it. We were asking tram drivers. In fact, we saw the trams arrive from the camp and let all these people out. And apparently we were some of the few people that at midnight wanted to go back. So we were asking the drivers, how do we get back? And they had no idea because they were taking their tram into the garage and nobody could tell us how to actually, obviously they had to go back there at some point to pick up more people, but not the ones that we were seeing. And we just eventually had to give up and not go back that night, which was kind of sad.
Yeah. So there's a special deal with the CCC because there's 17,000 people invading their town, that the transit system would go all night throughout the duration of the Congress. And that's really cool. But evidently, they didn't communicate that too well to all of the late night drivers.
Yeah, it was one disappointing thing. It's on, I think, like Saturday night. And so if you left, there was like this blackout period that was not either well publicized or not anticipated at all. But I'm sure someone would say that, you know, we should have looked at some wiki or something.
Yeah, or it's possible there was a way to get there, but we didn't know what it was and we couldn't find any documentation about it. And that's you know, what happens in things like occasions like this.
I had something similar happen to me with trams. I can't believe it was about 20 years ago in Prague. I had taken the subway, the metro, down towards the Charles Bridge. And then the metro shut off at midnight, and I had to take trams back. But getting back to where I was staying in this kind of off-the-beaten-path, cheap area of Prague 20 years ago was just next to impossible. Nobody knew how to do it. Like, literally nobody. It's the same thing, tram drivers. And so I just started walking because I knew it was sort of this way and up a hill. It started to get really sketchy, and I felt unsafe. So I went back, and something kind of incredible happened to me as I was walking back. I went down this hill. And I saw this gigantic American flag. This sounds like this jingoistic story now, but it wound up being the American Embassy. And I knocked on the door of the American Embassy.
Knocked on the door of the American Embassy? Really, you get lost in Prague and you go to the American Embassy?
I went to the American Embassy.
Wow.
It happened to be the 4th of July that same night.
Did you just realize that then?
No, I knew it was the 4th of July, and I said, well, there's the American Embassy. Why don't I knock on the door? So I knocked on the door. It was actually a little buzzer. It was an intercom.
Is there a fife and drum in the room?
Okay.
No, keep going.
You know, somebody basically said, you know, yes, can I help you, with a Southern American accent? And I said, yeah, I'm an American. I'm thoroughly lost in Prague. You know, and then this guy tells me, well, he just got there 2 weeks ago. He's with the Marines. And I said, well, come on. You know, I'm an American. I'm lost. There's got to be somebody over there who knows how I can get back. And finally, he opened up the door, and these Marines came over to me, and they said, you know, we don't know how the hell to get up there. It's like, but it's the 4th of July. We're in here. We're partying. We're having a few drinks, and we're going to go out afterwards. Why don't you just come out with us? I stayed out with these Marines partying until 7 in the morning when the train reopened, and I took the subway back.
Did they ask you to show any ID? I mean, you could have been, you know,
I could have been, exactly. This was pre-terrorism.
French or something.
This was 19...
all kinds of possibilities.
Yes, this is true. I could have been Canadian. That's true. This is 1998 when people, you know, trusted each other. It was pretty amazing, and it totally changed my conception of Marines at that point. That was my first real experience in hanging out with U.S. Marines, and it was in Prague and on the 4th of July, and... because of the tram situation, I had this great experience that I can now talk about on the radio.
It's not about Marines. I mean, yeah, we can all hang out with Marines and have a great time.
Of course, it's about trams.
But it's about finding your own way, you know,
yeah, exactly.
without having to go to your embassy. That's you know, for God's sake, you were just lost in a city one night. All you had to do was keep walking. You would have made it. You really would have.
So. But I wouldn't have had this story. I had such a great time. It was so much more fun than wandering around aimlessly in sketchy areas of Prague 20 years ago.
So with regard to the camps, it is certainly a totally different mode. You have all this stuff and space and people bringing basically a bit of their lives, as Mitch said. And that in and of itself is great because you can just survive together. And it is much, much smaller by comparison to the Congress events. And I would add that, like, the size of it being with so many people in the proximity, and like there are definite benefits and drawbacks that, like, you're kind of experiencing all at once, and And there's this incredible amount of infrastructure and capacity to host all these people who want to hear interesting talks and then, you know, congregate and bump into one another. But it is so big and so spread out. You can see all the incredible projects people have, and people are quite busy while they're there, and different regions of the world are represented, and different projects you can get interested in. But you're really out in this whole like universe of different things going on. It's very hard to bump into someone twice, and it's very awkward, I think, if you don't just open yourself up to just maybe bumping into something interesting and consuming yourself with that for a little bit,
without calling the Marines.
Well, exactly. But there's just so much there that you'll. You can't really see it all. So, like, I found myself bumping into a bunch of people picking at a PDP. I think it was a PDP 8. There were two of them at the Congress in the same area as the hardware hacking area, which itself was all arranged in a circle, and everything kind of went out from the center. Yeah, I just bumped into that stuff and got interested in that. And you know, who knew that that kind of equipment was, you know, alongside all these other people doing so much stuff, dance floors and all these kinds of sculptures. And a lot of it was kind of arranged with these dividers, kind of like big cubicles, which I thought was kind of interesting because you have so many different things going on and so much stimulation. It's kind of good to kind of separate a little bit and have different areas and zones. But it really is so massive and so much, it's such a confluence of activity that it's hard to just grasp. I think at one point, both E and I got a little like overwhelmed, and we just like kind of had to calm down with the stimulus because there's so many lights.
Yeah, we ran screaming around for about half an hour.
That was us, wasn't it?
Yeah, we couldn't stop.
No, we were running in circles.
Like a couple
and then
of
we ran
toddlers
out.
That got too much sugar.
Yeah, yeah. I think it was like a few two scooters like crossed us.
That's the other thing. Yeah, it was late at night. It was after midnight, and all these people. Remember this, Mitch? All these people going by on all kinds of wheeled devices, scooters, bicycles, unicycles. One of those things that burst into flame.
Hoverboards. Hoverboards were everywhere. I saw a kid riding a hoverboard sideways,
and
which I'd never seen before. He was just sitting on
it. It's like dim lighting. There's a staircase, for God's sake. You can go right off the edge. But, you know, they're all just basically fine. And it's an amazing thing to see. But what I really like to see with these hacker events, I like to see more of them in different places. Now, we learned of some that we hadn't heard about before. There's a camp, I think, in Denmark or something.
Yes,
all sorts of things we've never heard of.
Born Hack, I think.
And we need to compile this information and spread it around. Because, yeah, the Germans have perfected it. No question about that. But there are so many other countries that need to be doing things as well. I want to see more things in Poland. Hey, we went to the Krakow 2600 meeting.
We did.
That was awesome. It was great.
It was way up in this old building and a bunch of like restaurants.
45 minutes to find it.
Yeah, we had to like make all kinds of like send up flares and all this stuff just to find it. But it was in kind of a VR cafe. Kind of a internet cafe, but it was in the very top
but
of
But we didn't know where...
Building.
And here's where we can maybe do a better job. Addresses. You know, numbers, there's an infinite number of numbers. Okay, so when you give a number of an address, it doesn't have to encompass the entire block. You can have every building have its own unique number, and they don't do that in some cities. They just have, you know, number 3 on a particular block, and that encompasses about 50 different stores, and that makes it very hard to find things.
I think it was an old factory that had been repurposed and subdivided into all these little businesses.
You can add numbers later. There's all sorts of things you can do.
They had not quite got to that part of it yet, which is why I think it was so hard to navigate. But
it was great to see. Great to see that meeting and to talk to people there and to realize there's all kinds of meetings in the East. In Russia, there's a lot of 2600 meetings. It's very inspirational. It makes you want to do more here as well.
Yeah, and hearing about all that stuff, we're trying to organize it. I think we want to publish and get more listings of these kinds of meetings and check in with people. That's another big thing is, seeing who's out there, seeing what they're doing and letting them know we're listening and we want to share their activities and the kind of community they're creating. And, I think you are definitely doing as much work in the same spirit, Mitch, with all of your travels and so on.
Yes, but tell us someplace you've been that we don't know about, that we've never been to. A hacker event or a hacker space or a meeting or something in a country that maybe we haven't been talking about a whole lot.
I've been to a couple places over the last year that I've never been before. Poland is one of them, and I did a small tour of a bunch of cities in Poland and visited hackerspaces in all of them. And there's some really cool communities in Poland. And in times like this, community of like-minded people is very important. And also, I went to Israel for the first time, hanging out in a hackerspace in Tel Aviv. I was hacker in residence there for a month. And it's a place called TAMI, T-A-M-I, Tel Aviv Makers International. And fantastic community there. It's just mm-hmm. really wonderful to be there and surrounded by who knows what's going on in the rest of Israel. But here's a community of people who support each other and teach and learn like in any other hackerspace. And also this year, I went to, a month ago, I was in Dubai, which is a place I was quite apprehensive of going.
What's the hacker community like there?
There isn't one.
Okay, all right. That's a
but perhaps this is the beginning of starting one. I don't know. Dubai is...
There are definitely hackers there. There's no question about that.
Yeah, not necessarily in my definition of the word, but...
Well, they exist, whether they are able to exist openly. But there are people with hacker mindsets everywhere.
Oh, absolutely. There are humans everywhere. And Dubai is not a place where you walk around and you're feeling oppressed. It's a place where we read and hear about oppression there. Like a friend of a friend talked about their friend visiting to me before I went, and they were arrested for kissing someone in a taxi cab. And that's not the kind of story that makes me feel warm and fuzzy about going to Dubai. But evidently, it's a little bit different there. It's certainly different there than what I imagine, a theocratic state where people get arrested for kissing and where it's illegal to be gay, which, kind of illegal to be me. So, I'd been to Israel and there's a stamp in my passport from Israel. What's that going to be like at the border? It turned out that none of this mattered at all. If I went around with a placard yelling it, maybe it would have mattered. But it seems like the authorities, as long as they can turn a blind eye, they will. That's sort of the impression I get. And everyone, regardless of what they were wearing, the traditional garb or modern, was just warm and friendly and open. And I was with a conference called Hack in the Box. And I went there to.
I remember that.
And I've been to their conferences in Amsterdam, pretty much all of them over the
Malaysia
last 10 years.
Too. Have you been to the one in Malaysia?
I have not. They. I think that's where it started, but they don't do it there anymore. And there was one in Beijing, and I went to that one before my hacker trip to China.
So was there ever a place that you went to, either to visit hackerspaces or teach people how to solder, that you felt trepidation, that you thought maybe this isn't such a good idea? And maybe you were surprised.
Well, there's been very few places I've been in the world where I just didn't like being there. I was in Egypt in 2011, just a few months after Mubarak was booted. And that was a fascinating place to be. The culture was, I think, at the peak of optimism for, decades after. And that was a truly oppressive place. In part paid for by our tax money. But that's another story. And So being there, the hacker community there was just ready to explode in wonderful ways. And me and a couple other people going there to help people, bringing donations from hackerspaces from the U.S. and, you know, just greetings from the rest of the world. And people were welcoming in amazing ways. And we had these hackerspace meetups where 100 people would show up. And soon after we left, there were several hackerspaces throughout Egypt, and it would be great. I haven't been there since then. It would be great to visit again and see what's going on. But I was just hanging out yesterday with one of the people who started Cairo Hackerspace. He's now living in New York City. And he was telling me a bunch of stories about what's happening. It seems like it's really thriving there. The outlying culture in Egypt now is, like the rest of the world, hurting badly. That started happening much earlier than the rest of the world. But, it was one of the few places I've ever been where I felt it was actually dangerous to be. Because while I was there, the military leadership started getting nervous that people had kicked out the one guy, but they didn't kick out everybody else, the everybody else being the military leadership. And they got people quite easily by manipulating people through their religious hatreds, which unfortunately still exists there, into shooting each other in the streets while I was there. And, you know, it's interesting to read about, it's interesting to see, but it doesn't feel good.
Yeah, and so important to go and actually be with people and keep those communication channels open. And I think hacking and technology and the spirit that we are so fond of and we know is everywhere is a big part of having discussions and protecting, I think, communities around the world, so that we know what's going on in these places and that we can share and keep that spirit alive. I think in times like these, we need to have relatedness more than ever, and this is just one of the ways. Yeah, talking about different events, places, and sharing that common spirit and the warmness, because that's something we definitely notice as different or as awkward or maybe we don't have understandings or politically where we're from maybe shouldn't allow us to be able to communicate. But I think it's so true that people do like to laugh and share and that human friendliness is actually the norm and all too common in what we most enjoy in travel.
Yeah, so it is amazing. I mean, I do travel all over the world, and I'm traveling most of the time, and everywhere I go, I can always go to a local hackerspace and feel welcomed. And, just last night I'm at Hack Manhattan, and most people there had never heard of me, but I can walk in, and just like all these other people who came in who'd never been there before, and everyone's welcomed, and we can talk about anything. And we were all there till midnight, just having a great time talking about whatever came up. And this is true anywhere in the world. And whatever the external politics are, of course, we can talk about that as well, and even have disagreements and respect each other. Imagine that. And have a great time and support each other. And just having, one of the things I do, as well as many other people going around the world, sharing what works and what doesn't at all these different communities. And it's a great way for people to make their communities stronger and nicer.
I'm curious about one thing. We're talking about traveling all over the world. By the way, our phone number is 212-209-2877 if people want to join the conversation. Traveling all continents, pretty much. I don't think you've been to Antarctica yet.
Have Not you? Yet.
Okay. But have you ever been to a part of this country that is decidedly different as far as background, say, Trump country? Have you been there at a hackerspace? Have you talked to people? You talked about disagreeing and being able to respect people. Is it possible in that kind of environment?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Just like Alex is talking about, he's hanging out with Marines, we have preconceptions about all these different people. Deep down, we're all human, mm-hmm. And if we treat people with respect, people tend to be respectful in return. And this is something I learned long ago as a teenager while driving around the U.S. In a Volkswagen van, little hippie that I was. And you know, I saw Easy Rider. I know what the South is like, right? At least the Hollywood presentation of it. And that's partly true, but it's way wrong and false in many other ways. I found if I go there expecting people to be mean to me, that's what I get. And I had all sorts of weird bumper stickers on the back of my VW van. But if I'm friendly to people, mm-hmm. always people are friendly to me in return. And at Hackerspaces, I mean, there's so many things to talk about that aren't contentious political things. And you can start with that and then have a basis for connection, which we all have. And then you can talk about even the guy in the White House, and it's possible to talk about things in a way that it's not so bad.
All right. Well, that takes guts, and I think it's something we need more of. Let's take a phone call. Good evening. You're on Off the Hook.
Yeah, hi. I just want to make a comment about something you were talking about earlier.
Go ahead.
Yeah, a couple things. First of all, in reference to the dogs on the train, the gentleman that was talking about bringing dogs on the train, it's not allowed on the trains, and for very good reason. Not everybody likes dogs. You know, a lot of dog owners, to me, they're very selfish. They think everybody likes dogs, and everybody wants their dog sniffing them. Not everybody likes dogs, you know. And
do you like dogs, sir?
I don't dislike dogs. My mom has a dog, and, you know, uh-huh. there's always a dog there. But everybody doesn't like dogs, and it's not fair to impose your dog on everybody else. If you go on YouTube, you would see a lot of videos on with subways where, in fact, there's one there right now where this dog attacked this lady. Somebody brought a dog on the train, and mm-hmm. it bit this woman on the train. This is actually a recent story. Well, that's the thing about the dogs. But the other thing, though, is as far as the differences between the subways in England and European countries versus the New York subways. Mm-hmm. One thing is, though, in New York, we pay a lot less than they do. I think that's part of it. If you New York subway versus, say, the British subway system, I think New York is like decades behind, if not even a century behind. But I think we pay, in fact, I don't even think we do pay a lot less than they do. And I mean significantly, probably 25% on the dollar versus what they do. So that could be one of the reasons why it's, you know, our subway system is not as nice as they are. I'm quite sure if we were to start upgrading this subway system to rival the subway systems they have there, the fares are going to jump, and people probably not going to want to pay it. So that's one thing to keep in mind. I just wanted to make that comment.
All right. Thanks. Thanks for calling.
All right. Thanks.
Take care. You know, I don't know about the fares. They are more expensive in London, but I don't know if that carries over from all cities that are more advanced. I think it's unique to every country. Regarding dogs, though, Alex, you're the one who brings your dogs onto the subway. You know, there are people I don't like on the train, you know, I recognize they have the right to be there. I think, you know, some dogs know how to behave on trains, and I've noticed this in Europe. They all behave themselves really well. Even if another dog is there, they just lie down. They're trained. And if you don't train your dog properly, you're going to get incidents, obviously. But I don't think to malign the entire species is really the right thing to do.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with that entirely. And I would say, you know, the vast majority of people that come into contact with my dogs on a train are made happier by the presence of these particular dogs rather than sadder. And they probably are much more well-behaved than most of the strap hangers that we have in the city. But, you know, this sort of besides the point, I'm still going to engage in the civil disobedience on a near daily basis of bringing my dogs on the train.
Dogs on the train. That's
absolutely.
That's amazing.
A beagle and a Sheltie. But to go back to his comment, though, about paying less for our trains, I mean, this is something really unique to New York, and the subway system has always been known to be the great equalizer. So unlike London, where you're charged by distance, in New York, you could stay in the train all day, mm-hmm. and you pay a single fare. So you can go into the bowels of Queens if you wanted to, or take it two stops, and it's the same exact fare. Mm-hmm. Whereas in London, that two-stop trip would be much cheaper than...
Well, if you get off the train, if you stay on the train, you can stay on until they stop. Which is another thing. They stop. Our trains don't stop.
That's true.
And the reason for that is because you tap going out. And they have a tapping system, too, which I'm looking forward to in New York when we have a system where you actually the fare is calculated based on how often you use your card that day. So you pay the less amount. You say, you know, a day pass or, you know, for one fare, it calculates it for you. We'll have a system like that. Hopefully, it won't be based on distance, though.
No, and that's what I mean to say is that, you know, the system by design has been very, you know, equalizing. Mm-hmm. It's been an egalitarian system, and I agree. I don't want that to change at all.
All right, let's take another phone call. Good evening. You're on Off the Hook. Hi. Can you speak up a little bit? You seem to have something going on with your phone there.
Off screen. All right. Is this better?
Yeah, that's better. Go ahead.
Okay, good. All right. First, one comment about the fears. You know, the person who called before obviously doesn't travel much out of London because everywhere else in Europe, the fares are between €1-1.5. I'm talking about Spain. France has got an even better deal. If you go to Paris, you can buy 10 rides.
Yeah, that's right. Eastern Europe is insanely cheap.
Yes, so I would say that New York is rather on the high end rather than the low end. But specifically, again, I don't want to hijack the conversation because it took a very nice turn, and I don't want to put a damper on that. But that person had a distinct law enforcement accent. And without being too paranoid...
A law enforcement accent?
Yes.
Wow.
You know, without being too paranoid, you know, I just wanted to say specifically to Mitch that, you know, while we all travel with an open mind and we hope for a better world, you know, be careful about divulging your living arrangements so widely because a lot of people listen and they're not all friendly. You know, for example, in New York, the law says that if you have a rent-controlled or stabilized apartment, you have to live here 181 days a year and similar other things. So I don't know what your living arrangements are and how safe and secure your situations are, but just, you know, while we're all starry-eyed and we hope for a better world, we also have to keep our own situations in mind and try to protect them.
That's always good advice, and, yes. and thank you for sharing it with
and
us.
Thank you, and I'll listen to the rest of the show. Thank
okay.
you so much.
Have a good night. And yes, I think that's something we can all bear in mind. Keep our private information, you know, as private as we wish. I don't think we're giving out too much information here, any of us, but a lot of people do. A lot of people on Facebook and on Twitter and social media, they tell their entire story, and you can find out all kinds of things about them, and you really shouldn't be able to do that. And that's something that I think we as hackers need to educate people on.
Can you please tell me your mother's maiden name?
No. Well, you know what? I've never told anybody my mother's maiden name. I lie to every credit card company that asks that, and you can do that. You can totally do that. It's awesome. It's empowering. You don't have to tell the truth, you know, when giving that information out. And they're not entitled to know the actual facts as far as your personal life. Let's take another phone call. Good evening. You're on Off the Hook.
Hi. Talking about meeting Marines and getting a different take on them. I'm in the 80s. They were filming some video in Washington Square Park. The place was packed. I met two Marines who were on leave. They had both just taken LSD, and they were tripping.
Wow.
And I couldn't believe that. And they said that they were new to New York. And I said, well, you might. They said they were just going to get on a train and go somewhere and see what was happening while they were tripping.
Well, they didn't need to go on a train. They could have just stood still and all kinds of things.
Yeah, the park was filled at that time. You know, it was early. But, you know, Washington Square, that gets, you know, it gets empty as the night goes on. You know, the maybe 42nd Street is more, you know, hopping more throughout the night than it's Washington Square Park.
Well, 42nd Street on LSD, I would not recommend.
No, I know. But, right. Well, anyway, that was it. Okay.
Thanks for those memories. That's, wow. Okay, we're definitely...
What is the best street in New York for LSD?
Well,
if you're going to walk, not a two-way, walk around...
Not a two-way street, Kyle. Basically, I would recommend, if you're really asking, Lower Manhattan, westbound, because you don't have the threat of the sun coming up. You know, if you don't have a bike lane, that just confuses things.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I can go on, but we're almost out of time. Let's take another phone call. Good evening. I'm sorry. I didn't press the button hard enough. And that one I pressed too hard. Okay. Good evening. You're on Off the Hook. Go ahead. Speak up. Hi.
I like what you guys said about when you go to places, you know, you get what you put out. I like that.
Mm-hmm.
And just, I don't know, at the risk of being a little personal, how does your guest finance all this travel around the world? And I'll take my answer up here.
Okay, that's a very good question.
Yeah, so
reveal your secrets.
my secrets. So, you know, let me try to be succinct, but I created a situation where I can make a living doing what I love. And when you do something along those lines, other people seem to like it. So I get paid to give talks and workshops all over the world. Quite often there's an organization, a conference, that will pay for my travel expenses. And sometimes they'll even pay me for the talk or the workshop. And while I'm there, then I have the opportunity to be in a certain place, and then I can visit places that have no budget and do stuff for free. And overall, every year, I don't make any money whatsoever from doing all the travel and the talks and the workshops that I do, but I don't lose money. So basically, I get to travel all over the world for free and meet all these amazing people and do all these amazing things, have all these amazing experiences. And it's almost as if I'm, you know, super wealthy and I live as if I am.
But Mitch, I bet you travel like a hacker.
Oh, yeah, I do.
Yeah, there's probably things.
Well, what does that mean?
Well, I don't know. The thing I'm hearing is that, yeah, it's impossible. How would you do this? But I bet there's tips and tricks and tools and ways to do it that our listeners probably aren't imagining. You know, when they think of travel, it's got to be one or the other type of logistical situation. And it's not like the kind of travel you might think of where you're going to take a family vacation or something so formal. And there's so many cool things with technology that have made it easier. Just the ability to find something we talk about all the time, the best deal, you know, with tickets and flights. And, of course, trains are right in there as far as your transportation goes. Or taking a mode of transportation that's going to be doubling as accommodations. That's a trick we love. We made great use of that. And then also the types of places you go, oftentimes the dollar's pretty strong there, and you can save even more with just the types of places you go and the things you're not taking advantage of being a traditional, say, tourist. So that I think is worth mentioning.
Yeah, and also being part of the hacker scene. If I go to a conference, quite often they'll put me up in a hotel, and like in Dubai, the hotel was over the top. I mean, it's beyond 5 stars, but that's not the norm for me. Normally, I prefer staying with people who have a spare couch or a spare room is luxury, mm-hmm. and then I get to get the perspective of these people's hometown from their, you know, geeky, unique perspective. And it's really wonderful to be in a place, not just to see it and gawk at it, but to go there and be a part of it.
I smell a book deal out of this for you, Mitch. Definitely that can finance further travel around the world. Let's work on that. Let's get that together by next week.
Great. We'll do lunch.
All right. Perfect.
Yeah. Well, you know, also, Kyle and I have been traveling for about 5 weeks now. We're not wealthy. We're not spending a lot of money. We're staying in places that literally cost $30 a night in Krakow. That's what it cost. And it was a nice place, too. It was really nice. $30 a night. Or, you know, you figure out a way to travel. We took an airline called WOW, literally, and it cost $100 to get from Europe to Iceland. It was scary, yes, no question about it, but it worked. And you have to think of things that kind of defy the odds, the system. Think like a hacker, and you can always get from one place to another.
Yeah, expensive telephone, like data plans are sort of ridiculous when you think about how much Wi-Fi there is all around the world, which is a kind of underrated technology. But when you're on the road, you're always on the lookout for a way to get online or do something without having to pay an arm and a leg. And that's stuff we've definitely talked about in the past. And I encourage anybody out there thinking of traveling or that is inspired to check out other places and see what kind of tech they have or what kind of cool communities are out there. Use as many of the different things we've talked about, and maybe you'll come up with your own techniques for making that kind of lifestyle and those trips affordable.
Yeah, I think part of what we always hear as hackers is that certain things are impossible. It's impossible to put out a magazine. It's impossible to do a radio show. It's impossible to do a conference in the middle of New York City. And it's impossible to go from one place to another for cheap. Well, all of that is possible if you think like a hacker, if you keep investigating, keep searching for answers, keep trying different things, and keep sharing the information, because that is what hackers do. I want to thank people for taking part in the conversation. Mitch Altman, thank you so much for everything you do and for inspiring us. And we look forward to hearing your adventures in the future. You can write to us, oth@2600.com. We'd love to hear from you. And we will be back again next week. Same time, same station. Stay tuned for Exploration next. Good night.
Turning 15 on the Road to Freedom tells the moving true story of Linda Blackman, the youngest person to walk all the way from Selma to Montgomery, Alabama, on the Voting Rights March in 1965. Jailed 9 times before her 15th birthday, Lowry fought alongside with Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. to secure the right to vote for African Americans. This amazing story has been adapted to a play, and performances will be held at Riverside Church on Saturday, January 19th at 2 p.m. and 7 p.m. and on Sunday, January 20th at 2 p.m. and 6 p.m. For more information, you can call 212-870-6792 or go online to turning15riverside.eventbrite.com.
Welcome. This is Dr. Michio Kaku, professor of theoretical physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York,
and this is Exploration. Every week in Exploration, we discuss the fascinating world of science and its impact on society. And first of all, I'd like to wish everyone a happy new year. And let's hope that 2019 is better than 2018. 2018 saw massive fires, flooding, even earthquakes and natural disasters around the world. And some people are hoping that 2019 will be better than 2018. But anyway, let's just jump right into some of the top stories in science of the past week. First of all, the History Channel. The History Channel has a new series debuting in January, and it's about, well, you guessed it, flying saucers. Project Blue Book was a top secret program to investigate all these sightings of flying saucers from 1952 to 1969. So we'll say a few things about that. And then we'll say a few things about hypersonic drones. Are they responsible for some of the UFO sightings? And for that matter, is there going to be a new missile gap? The Russians have, they say, perfected the hypersonic drone. The United States seems to be lagging. And what does that mean? And then we'll talk about, well, outer space. We're talking, first of all, about the Chinese. The Chinese made history a few weeks ago by landing a rover on the backside of the moon. It's the Chang'un 4 probe. It's actually the second lunar landing that the Chinese have executed. This is the first time, however, that a probe landed on the backside of the moon. So we'll say a few things about, well, is there a dark side of the moon or not? And what does it mean? And then let's talk about NASA. NASA scored a bullseye with the New Horizons spacecraft, which flew past Pluto and now flew past the farthest object in the solar system, in the Kuiper Belt. So what does that mean? And then we'll say a few things about another NASA milestone, TESS. The replacement for the Kepler satellite has found 8 new planets just in the past 4 months. 8 new planets, and of course, none of them look like the Earth at all, meaning that we are really the cosmic oddballs in the universe. We don't see any twin of the solar system in outer space. And then I'll answer some of the emails that I get. It's impossible to answer all of them. However, I'll take the opportunity to answer a few of them. One email that I got concerning my colleague, Stephen Hawking, the late Stephen Hawking, who posthumously came out with a new book. And that book talks about God. And it says that, well, Stephen Hawking did not believe in the existence of God because there was no time, after the instant of the Big Bang to create the universe. Therefore, God doesn't exist. Well, does that really hold up, given the fact there are alternate histories of the early universe? We'll talk about that in today's exploration. Well, first of all, leading off in the month of January, the History Channel has a new TV program about Project Blue Book. Let me explain. Back in the 1950s, there were lots of UFO sightings, especially after World War II. And some people were thinking that, well, maybe there's a rhyme or reason to these things. And, of course, the military is entrusted with national security. And if the Russians, or some extraterrestrials were able to perfect rockets that could soar across the solar system, that nation, that planet, would have a tremendous advantage over the United States military. So the military was very much interested in setting up Project Blue Book from 1952 to 1969. Believe it or not, scientists there investigated 12,000 sightings. Imagine going through the records of 12,000 sightings of strange lights in the sky. Well, let's be honest. For the most part, over 90% of them could be dismissed using ordinary science, climatology, chemistry, and physics. For example, quite a few of these sightings were meteorites, meteors that soared across the sky, lighting up the sky, and Quite a few of them were atmospheric anomalies. It turns out that in a thunderstorm, you can have all sorts of atmospheric anomalies that apparently resemble flying saucers, not to mention the planet Venus. You see, many children say, "Mommy, Daddy, the moon is following me." That's right. When you walk around, let's say you walk around a field and you look back over your shoulder and you see the moon, well, that moon is in the same position everywhere you wander around that field. That gives you the optical illusion that the moon is following you when it's not following you at all. It's a matter of what is called parallax. So we are deceived by the moon because it is so far away, it has no parallax whatsoever. And so we think that the planet Venus is following us. Now, if you're driving down a country road and you look back in the rearview mirror and you see Venus, it really does seem to follow you. In fact, President Jimmy Carter, when he was president of the United States, he publicly mentioned that he saw a UFO and he had the military investigate it. And the military said that for the best of their ability, it probably was the planet Venus. Well, the point I'm raising is 90-95% of these sightings of strange things in the sky could be dismissed as natural phenomenon or artificial phenomenon such as radar echoes. Radar can bounce off mountains, giving you fake shadows of objects. And yes, it turns out that radar echoes is responsible for some of these sightings by Air Force officials. However, that said, there were 700 sightings that could not be explained using ordinary laws of physics. And so then the question is, how do you explain that? How do you explain the fact that on many occasions, not just one, but several pilots would see objects following them and seemingly disappearing faster than any known aircraft? Well, some of those sightings, in hindsight, because back in 1969, much of this was still classified, some of these sightings that aren't explained can be explained by testing of the stealth bomber. We now know that at Area 51, the military conducted extensive tests of military craft that were invisible to radar. Now, radar, of course, is a nation's first line of defense. It allows you to track objects in the sky. However, using the laws of physics and electromagnetism, you can design a craft, an airplane, that has a very small radar signature, about the size of a large bird. You can play with the shape of the wings, the composition of the aircraft itself, and you can redesign an aircraft, not necessarily to be the fastest airplane in the sky, but to be the airplane with the smallest radar signature. And that's the stealth bomber. And we now realize that the military actually allowed, and in fact encouraged, people to say that these strange sightings were in fact alien flying saucers because it deflected from the military's own program of designing the stealth bomber. Well, now you may say to yourself that, well, we're past Project Blue Book and we still have these sightings of pilots seeing something hovering next to them, speeding off at fantastic velocities, and they're not the stealth bomber. Well, another possibility is they are hypersonic drones. Now, let me explain. Last year in March, Vladimir Putin announced a new weapon that gives it an edge over the United States military, the hypersonic drone. In the press release, the Russians claimed that it can go to Mach 20 times the speed of sound, and the purpose is largely defensive. That is, it can evade a Star Wars program. When a missile comes in from outer space, it's traveling at about 18,000 miles per hour. When it hits the atmosphere, it's basically on a trajectory given to us by Newton's laws of motion. There's no pilot, it cannot maneuver, and therefore, in some sense, it's a sitting duck to a Star Wars shield that can lock onto that missile, calculates its future trajectory, and then send up anti-missiles to blow it out of the sky. But you see, if that incoming missile is maneuverable, it can evade a Star Wars system, because the Star Wars systems assume that the incoming